Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Renee Powers here. In case you are new here, I am the founder of Feminist Book Club, and July is actually our second anniversary as a company. Can you believe that? I have always envisioned this company growing into what I've said, the premier hub for intersectional readers. And that vision is slowly becoming realized. So thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for supporting us in every way. If you haven't heard, our August book of the month is Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot by Mickey Kendall. This is part of our theme, Reimagining the Feminist Canon. If you would like to join us this month, make sure you head to feministbookclub.com to get a copy of the book and then get access to our Facebook group, Slack space, and Zoom calls. You can choose all of those, none of those, one, two of those, whatever you would like. I am excited to also share that we can now offer ASL interpretation with our Zoom meetings upon request. So if that is a service you would like or need, just reach out. This interview is honestly one of my favorites of all time. I could talk to Meredith Toulousan for hours, seriously. There are a handful of interviews that I conducted that feel like warm hugs, and this is one of them, but like a warm hug that makes you rethink everything you thought you knew about gender and race? Sure, we'll go with it. Meredith's newest memoir, Fairest, is about her experience as an albino Filipino trans woman who immigrated to the US as a 15-year-old. As always, links to her book and books mentioned in this episode, as well as a list of all of our past guest books, are in the show notes. In this interview, we discuss gender in the United States versus growing up in the Philippines, how Meredith passes as a white woman, and all of the baggage that comes with this perception of white fragility despite her identity as a person of color, how her ambivalent relationship to gender complicates generally convenient narratives of trans experiences, and so much more. You will want to listen to this episode more than once. Go out and buy her book immediately. It's Fairest. Now, stay tuned for this interview. Welcome back, everyone. I'm so excited to be talking with Meredith Toulousan today. Meredith is an award-winning author and journalist who is the founding executive editor of Them, which is Condé Nast's LGBTQ digital platform, where she's now contributing editor. She's contributed to other books, including the New York Times bestseller, Not That Bad, edited by Roxane Gay, which was one of our previous books of the month, Nasty Women, and Burn It Down. She writes frequently for the New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, Wired, Condé Nast Traveler, and many other publications. She lives in the Western Catskills with her spouse and rescue mutt. And today we're talking about her brand new memoir, Fairest. Welcome, Meredith.
Thank you so much. It's slightly embarrassing to have your bio read, right? Like, I'm still getting used to that. Where it's like, it feels nice, you know, for things to be in print and you're just imagining that people are reading it. But then when it's actually read orally, I don't know. It's not that it's embarrassing. Like, maybe that's a little bit gendered of a reaction on my
interesting
part.
We're getting right into it.
Right. Yeah. Well, yes, I think about gender constantly, but I'll probably like ask my publicist to shorten my bio, just because he's like, oh, you know, like that just seems like so much to.
Well, you're very accomplished and I think you should own it. That's my two cents. Okay, so before we get started, we always ask, what does feminism mean to you and what does it mean to you be a feminist?
Feminism to me means a movement to end oppression based on gender, which in our culture, because of Western patriarchy, is really prevalent among women and gender nonconforming people. I guess that would be my short answer.
And you have a very unique position to be talking about gender in the West, particularly. Can you tell us about, for anyone who's not familiar with this book yet, which is bonkers to me, you need to go out and buy it yesterday. But for those in the audience who are not familiar with your memoir, Fairest, can you share a little bit what it is and what your memoir covers?
Oh dear. Okay. Do you want me to spend the hour doing that?
But, yes.
But in brief, let me start with my identities, I guess, would be the easiest thing to do, which is that I am an albino trans woman who grew up in the Philippines and moved to the States at 15 and had a child star career in the Philippines in between. I guess that's relevant. And then subsequently ended up going to Harvard for undergrad. And then after that, ended up being and, you know, coming out as gay and then being partnered with a man who at the time was an heir to a baronetry. It's like something out of Jane Austen, right? And is now properly a baronet. And then, and as a result, you know, there was a running joke that if gay marriage became legal, that I would be called Lady Wedgwood, which is what baronets' wives are called. And that sort of, that was one of the calls that I heard in terms of me thinking about my gender, and ultimately deciding that it would be better for me to transition despite all of the turmoil and heartbreak that it would lead in my life. And what the book does is it tells that story chronologically, pretty much chronologically, but intersperses moments in which I jump forward in time because I transitioned in the early 2000s, but there are sections that are written as late as 2018 that reflect on those events and how they affected my life at present. And I think that's pretty much, that's actually not bad for a summary, because people have asked me to summarize this book at, you know, like at dinner and stuff. And I was just like, I don't know if that's possible, but.
I could tell that you've been doing this a couple of times.
Yeah, I've gotten better at it.
It's great. So I think it's so interesting. And you mentioned that there is some kind of flash forward moments too. And the book begins at your college reunion at Harvard. And it's the first time you've been back to Harvard, correct me if I'm wrong, post-transition. So as a woman.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that one of your college classmates says is, oh, you look the same.
Right.
And
right.
You take the first chapter to really unpack that and sit with how uncomfortable and also affirming that feels, that you are not necessarily different by any means. Your gender presentation is much different.
Yeah, I feel like by the time 2017 rolled around, and that's the thing, is that my identity is constantly evolving and shifting. I think in part because the way that gender is structured in our society is fundamentally flawed. And so I feel like all of us, to a greater or lesser extent, are trying to navigate through that flawed system. And for somebody like me in particular, who doesn't really fundamentally believe that system works, I'm constantly changing and adjusting. And, you know, 2017 was definitely a period when I was feeling really just kind of exhausted with all of the ways in which women's presentations are policed and judged and, you know, subject to scrutiny, all of the ways in which beauty becomes so prioritized over other concerns when it comes to women. And so when I got to reception, I was aware that I was presenting certainly not as I would have at other points. You know, had I gone to my 5-year reunion rather than my 20-year reunion, I would have been super femme and wearing high heels and, you know, like in a really cute dress, et cetera, et cetera. So I was aware that I wanted to present myself in a way that was comfortable, that communicated that I was comfortable with myself and my identity as a trans woman. But I think that that line, you know, that the you look the same line, which a lot of people said, actually, Sean was not the, you know, not just one person who said that, really threw me for a loop, right? Because I had made so many sacrifices in order to get to where I am. So it felt really strange for people to say, you know, like, oh, you're the same, you know, like you're just exactly as how I remember you. And so I ended up just really, really reflecting on that and coming to the book is really one of the ways that the book has helped me is come to greater terms with that, that there shouldn't be a conflict between my past self and my present self. Even if I lived as a different gender up until my mid-20s, my early mid-20s, I don't know how to say that, until I was 23. So yeah, and I think the book is really one of the things that the book is trying to do is to unpack all of the complexities of that, which I think is something that has been really difficult for trans women to do because all of our actions are being judged by this cisgender public that doesn't understand us in a lot of different contexts, right?
And yet the book also illuminates how womanhood is an illusion, that we're all performing something. And it also illuminates how whiteness is an illusion as well. And I think the title fairest is so brilliant because as an albino woman, albino Asian woman, you pass as white and yet you also carry the history of your Filipino upbringing. So can you talk a little bit about how that feels to pass as white and how that maybe influences how others see you, how others see beauty as reflected in you, and a little bit of unpacking of all those intersectional identities.
I think the eeriest thing for me about passing as white is that you forget about it. Mm-hmm. It's both the eeriest and the most pernicious thing about it is that unless you're actively thinking, you know, like passing for white is like passing for left-handed when you're right-handed, right? Like, I don't know. I don't know what metaphor it is. Like it's something that you have to actively think about. And I think that that's really difficult because of the fact that race and people's perception of your race is unfortunately such an important aspect of what it means to be in America, right? And so I find myself backtracking a lot, right? I would have an experience. And these days, a lot of the time, I don't have a lot of experiences as much that are blatantly racist or have blatant racial dimensions. So a lot of the time, what I have to do is actually live an experience and then think about it in retrospect and say, oh, you know, I'm not sure if this person that I'm interacting with would treat me in this particular way if they knew that I wasn't white, let alone that I'm trans, right? And that's something that I constantly think about, but I've been thinking particularly about because of the ways in which white womanhood is the trope of white fragility and white tears and white women kind of like using tropes of vulnerability to be able to really as weapons, right? Really as weapons that are wielded against people of color and especially Black people and in many instances, Black men. And so that's something that is really pretty foremost in my mind right now because of the fact that it has such an important gendered dimension, that it's not just white men who are oppressing Black people and minorities. And that also I properly belong to that POC Indigenous community. I think one of the biggest differences between me and other white passing people is that most other white passing people have some European heritage, you know, so they have a white family member, they have an imaginary access to a European heritage, whereas I am white passing, but I have no European heritage at all. And so it literally is the case that people perceive me, the perception that people have of me is just diametrically opposed to my internal understanding of myself, right?
Let's talk a little bit about how it felt to revisit that time growing up in the Philippines. And I'm curious about how you felt writing those years. We get a lot of your story prior to your ascent as a child star, mm-hmm. and growing up very poor with your grandmother and right. those relationships and that experience. Can you share a little bit about how that felt writing those years?
I think rendering those years specifically was really illuminating to me, because one of the things that I realized as someone who relies so much on what I've read in order to understand myself, and also as someone who is trans in a world where trans literature and things to read about trans people and trans people's experiences is still pretty limited, right? I found myself, I knew and I was aware that my trans experience, especially my childhood trans experience, was distinct from other people's, in the sense that I knew that I had never had that feeling of being trapped, or, you know, like my body not feeling right. Not feeling right in my own skin in this sort of like fundamental way. But it took a long time for me to just really, really specify that. And I remember this moment when, you know, like one of the first sections of the book ends with me, I was completely obsessed with, and I continue to still be completely obsessed with Leia Salonga, who was a child star in the Philippines when I was growing up and has gone on to star in Miss Saigon and win a Tony Award and be, you know, this sort of worldwide.
She was the voice of Mulan, right?
She was the voice of Mulan and Jasmine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's like the pride of the Philippines. So
I'm obsessed with her too. I felt such a kindred spirit. Miss Saigon is one of my all-time favorite musicals. So
Despite it being problematic, right?
Exactly. You know, like
it's her guilty pleasure.
Exactly.
but I think remembering that period and remembering that time, you know, I could have easily rendered that period. And I think I might have in an early draft as like, I wanted to be a girl. I wanted to be Leia Salonga. And actually I had to excavate those memories and really specify them, and in order to get that nugget, that's not quite right. What I felt was that if I had Leia Salonga's voice, I wouldn't mind being a girl, right? And that was, I think, you know, because that's early in the book, and I write relatively chronologically, I think that really initiated for me this method of just being like, no, like, don't just settle for the, you know, for the thing that is general, you know, like try to really reach into your experience in order to figure out what your specific relationship to gender was at that point. And I think for me, or one of the thing that I felt in the Philippines that's distinct from how I felt in the US was in the Philippines, it was, I wouldn't mind if I were a girl, you know, because in the Philippines, genders are less segregated especially in Indigenous society, you know, third gender people are more accepted. It didn't feel as oppressive being gendered male. And I think it was only when I came to the States, when I was just like, oh, you know, like it's like so incredibly limiting being male. I can't, you know, like dress in the ways that I want. I can't behave in ways that I want. You know, like I just felt really policed, not just by other people, but my own sort of like internal conception of what being a man in America should be.
I copied this quote, like I hand wrote this quote.
Amazing.
That
please take a picture for me. I love to see people's handwriting.
But you write, addressed to me meant the release from the shackles of forced masculinity. And I love how much you do grapple with masculinity in the United States specifically, and gay masculinity in the United States, and how that felt like an oppressive church. You call it like a gay church, and you
and you, the, you draw some and the gym was their church, you know, the gym was mass.
It adds such a welcome lens to the trans experience that you express kind of a reluctance to being a trans woman. Can you talk a little bit about that hesitance and your kind of reluctance of gender more broadly?
I think that one of the things that I think is actually oppressive about how trans women are pressured by society to exhibit, to sort of like frame their experience in ways that are convenient for cis people, is we have to be perfectly convinced our entire lives that we were meant to be women. We have to not experience this shroud of doubt, right? And we have to experience it as like this, you know, this like life and death need. And that's really convenient for cisgender people, because cisgender people can say, oh, she didn't have a choice, therefore I have to accept her, right? And that's not a standard that cis people put on themselves, right? Like you don't say, oh, like, you know, because having children, getting married are really big consequential life decisions that cis people are allowed to regret all the time. I mean, maybe the having children part, you can't say that out loud as much, but I just mean that there's so much latitude that are given to cis people to hesitate and to be reluctant about decisions. And one of the things that I realized working on the book is that I had absorbed that language of, oh, like I'm sure, you know, like I don't regret my transition, et cetera, et cetera. And that's just not human. You know what I mean? Like, is it just true that like you never thought, you never had, you know, just sort of like sitting in your bed, you know, like lying in bed at night, late at night, you know, like what would it be like if I were still a man? And it's just not realistic. I think even for, you know, for trans women for whom they've had that really strong dysphoric experience. And not only is it unrealistic, it's also oppressive, because it turns us into beings that need to be perfect in order to be loved and accepted. And it's a really gross double standard, and is really psychologically punishing. So it was one of my, as soon as I grasped onto this idea and to this insight that, oh, actually I've had, you know, like really significant periods of regret over transitioning. I don't think I've ever regretted. I mean, what's really funny is that, and what's distinct about my identity is that a lot of trans women are perfectly willing to say that they regretted having been born trans, right? That they would have, in a perfect world, wanted to have been born cisgender. And the ironic thing about me is that I have actually never regretted being trans. I actually really like being trans. It's kind of fundamentally just sort of not in my, I don't know, like in my emotional makeup to think, oh, like I regret being trans. But I have had significant experiences of regret over transitioning. And I think those two experiences are distinct, right?
Mm-hmm. I want to just reiterate something that you said about perfection as a vehicle for love and acceptance. I think that is such a universal feeling, and not to minimize all of your unique experiences, but I think we can all relate to having to perform something perfectly in order to be loved and accepted. I think that is really profound.
Yeah, I think one of my friends who read the book said something that really resonated with me, which was that actually, you know, your experiences are unique, but they are more just sort of like extreme and apparent forms of smaller experiences that other people feel and that other people live on a, you know, on a regular basis, which is part of why, even if my experience is really, really specific, that a lot of different people have had entry points into the book, and it's been really great. Every person that I've spoken to about it has approached it from a different and distinct angle. And that's something that I really appreciated about talking to people about the book.
Yeah. What prompted you to write a memoir? Why now, and why your story?
There were a number of different factors. You know, one of them was that I was doing a ton of investigative reporting. And during that period, when I was telling other trans people stories, I just sort of started jotting down notes about, you know, like about my experience. And then I was a staff writer at BuzzFeed News. And one of the first things that I did for them in August of, I think it was October of 2015, was this review article about trans memoir, in which I read, you know, like I read very intensely like 8 trans memoirs in 2 weeks or something like that. And one of the things that I got about that experience was the way in which so many of those memoirs, not in all of the parts, but they all had significant parts in which A, the trans woman was trying to explain what being trans was like to other people, and also B, justify their choices of being trans. And for me, having read, you know, I'm a really voracious reader, and I've read a ton of memoirs and a ton of autobiographical books. I was just like, I don't think that onus exists for a lot of other memoirists. You know, like when I think of the memoirs that I find the most memorable, the mode in which first of all, it's not a mode of explanation, right? Like it's a mode of narration. But also for me, the most affecting memoirs, the ones that I look back on and read over and over again, are memoirs in which the author is trying to make sense of the experience for themselves, right? The two examples that are like off the top of my head are Kaya Saleeman's Heavy, which is, I was asked recently, like which 10 books I would take to a desert island, and that was one of them. And Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking. I think both of those books are, because experience is already complex enough, right? That I think you actually have to engage with explaining it to yourself before you can explain it to other people. And because of the fact that when you explain something to someone else, that person doesn't have your set of experiences, you necessarily have to simplify your explanation to other people. And for me, I love, you know, intricate experiences and, you know, really specific details, because they're what give texture to a life, right? Like they're what makes one that's a way for people to move beyond their identity categories, and for me to get to know the specific person and that person's specific experience.
I could talk to you for hours. I think
part two.
Right. No, this conversation is so good, and it is exactly how I needed to start my day. But we are winding down, and I know you're working on something else, so we'll have you back when the next book comes out. So we'll talk about that in the future. Put a pin in this conversation.
Also, highly feminist.
Doesn't matter. Honestly, at this point, it doesn't matter. This is absolutely going to be, Ferris will be on my list of best books of the year. I absolutely loved it. I think it is incredibly important. I know that you are a book lover, and you just mentioned Heavy and Year of Magical Thinking, which we will leave in the show notes. But we do always ask our authors, if you have another book to recommend that's not your own that you think our audience should check out, what would you recommend them?
I am currently in the middle of On Being Human by Jennifer Pasteloff. And I'm one of those people who I read physical book and audiobook simultaneously because it helps me focus. And the wonderful thing about reading this book on audio is that Jennifer has become an expert, you know, like she teaches all of these workshops around the concept of listening to yourself and listening to other people, but she is deaf. She progressively lost her hearing as a young person and has become almost completely deaf now. And there's something so profound to me about the idea of somebody communicating their ideas and their thoughts to the world without being able to sort of hear themselves in their head, and that, you know, and that I'm listening to this audiobook that somebody is narrating, but that they can't listen to themselves. So that's, you know, a particularly affecting experience, especially when the book is all about listening, is all about being vulnerable to people and being able to, you know, being able to let people's stories come into you and be able to affect you and vice versa, which I find difficult to do. I'm a very vulnerable person on the page, but it's actually hard for me to be vulnerable in real life. I think I said something like that I'm a cancer on the page and a Taurus on the stage or something like that on Twitter once. And I think that's true. So Jen's book, we've met once, so I call her Jen now.
Of course.
Because, you know, that's the way it is. But I feel like her book is leading me towards a path in which I can experience and explore that vulnerability, not just as a writer, but also as a person living out in the world. And I'm really looking forward to that.
That sounds like a beautiful experience. Thank you for sharing that. And I will leave links to both the physical book and the audiobook in the show notes, as well as your book, Ferris. It is fantastic. Go out, like I said, go out and buy it yesterday. So my final question is an easy one. We'll lob a softball at you. Where is the best place to find you online if we want to learn more about your work and see what you're working on and connect with you?
So my website is mtolucin.com. So mtolucin.com, it's just my first initial last name. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at the number one Demerith. So it's just Demerit with an H at the end. And you will see that I'm a very serious writer on the page, but I'm a very silly person everywhere else. And also for people who are interested in writing, I offer free writing workshops on a regular basis. It's one of the things that it's been very important for me to be able, as somebody who finds myself in this position of being a more established writer, as somebody who comes from a marginalized background, to offer resources as free and as low cost as possible to get as many people who come from those backgrounds to be able to enter what are considered these rarefied and elite worlds. And you can find information about that on my website.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And I can attest to your very fun side on Instagram, especially. I've really been enjoying your ukulele playing.
Oh, yeah. I'm learning the ukulele right now. It's really fun. I haven't posted a ukulele Instagram yet, but I have made really significant progress because of quarantine. So
wonderful.
Next time, watch out for it.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Meredith. Yeah, I'll save all of the accolades, but this has been so wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been wonderful for me too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.